On today's 21st, Liz Pryor was your typical Winnetka teenager.
It was early January 1979. Baby, I Love Your Way was playing on the car radio. I had just turned 17 and was a very young senior in high school. I'd grown up my whole life knowing I was loved, knowing I would always have a place I belonged.
And then she got pregnant. We'll speak with Liz Pryor about her experience being sent away to a government-run facility to hide her pregnancy and birth. Later, we talk with one of the four teenagers who organized yesterday's Black Lives Matter protests that drew more than 200 teenagers to downtown Chicago. And
I am riding my bike around on the quad trying to find them and capture them. I don't have to go to work today, so instead I'm hunting Pokemon.
Illinois gets into the Pokemon Go craze. We're collecting local tips for the wildly popular augmented reality game and hearing more about privacy concerns. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Liz Pryor had probably the typical life of a new career high school student in the 1970s, growing up in a wealthy family in suburban Chicago. Then she found out she was pregnant. She's waited almost four decades to tell her story of how her family kept that pregnancy a secret and sent her to a government facility in order to do so. It's all detailed in her new memoir, Look at You Now, My Journey from Shame to Strength. Liz is coming back to Illinois this week. She's speaking tomorrow in Chicago at the Bookseller, Thursday in her hometown of Winnetka, and Friday in Lake Forest, and joins us now from her home in California. Liz, welcome to the 21st. Welcome back to Illinois, at least to our airwaves.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to it.
Liz, do you think that the way I described your childhood, do you think it was a typical sort of North Shore childhood?
I think so, yes. Very, you know, I look back on it as being pretty wonderful. Life is, life can be a tough place, and in Winnetka, it's pretty nice.
So you grew up with your mom and your dad, lots of siblings, and then you had a boyfriend. And did you, can you tell me how you, did you truly not realize that you were pregnant?
Truly, yes. You hear that and you don't believe it, but it was the first time I had sex, and I didn't really think I had it. And honestly, I'm sure there was enormous amounts of denial, but I'd only really, I just wasn't on it, wasn't aware of it. And until someone actually said something to me, my father's second wife mentioned something to me on vacation because I was getting sick and I was looking different. And of course, the minute she said it, I realized, wow, that might be what's happening here.
And so then you find out that you are indeed pregnant. At that point, you had just turned 17?
No, I was 16. I turned 17 in November. So, yes, I think I just turned 17.
You just turned 17. And when your family's having this discussion, so at this point, your parents are divorced. As you said, your father had remarried. So you're living with your mom. Your mom and dad aren't really communicating that much, but they get together and they decide, they basically decide, and you didn't really have any part in this, that they're going to send you away. Do you remember that time when they're having all these conversations? I imagine you were kind of numb and in shock. What was it?
A pretty vivid scene in the book. I mostly remember it because my parents, I don't think I had seen my parents together since they got divorced, and I felt terrible for being the instrument to force them together, and it was very controversial. The one thing they agreed upon was that no one could know. So then they moved forward as to decide where I would go. And it was originally intended that I would go to a Catholic home for unwed mothers, which is really where I thought I was going. So my mother sort of took charge. And when she brought me a couple states away to this facility, I realized immediately that it wasn't a Catholic home because it had a big sign on the outside that said locked facility. So we go in to learn that it was a government-run facility for sort of wayward, underprivileged, and several juvenile delinquent girls who were pregnant, which was a very foreign and terrifying world to me. I was safe in there. My parents assured me that I was not on lockdown, I could leave, but it was shocking.
Right. There's a moment where you write, I feel like I've been flopped into the land of misfit toys. Can you describe to everyone the other young women who were in the facility with you?
Yes, you know, I really, up until that point, I really didn't have a sense of the reality that there were kids in our country who didn't have parents who loved them, or, you know, one girl was raped by her stepfather, who really didn't have people who cared about them. They were from pretty much the same walk of life, all of them, sort of under the poverty line, and somewhat happy to be in a place where there was a bed and food. So for me, it was completely juxtaposition. And as terrifying as it was, it's interesting that in the book, in the beginning, you know, one doesn't realize how they're going to get through something. And certainly by the end, 5.5 months later, I come to realize I'm one of the luckiest people in the world. I have a family who loves me. Although I was there for 5.5 months, I have a whole future ahead. So it really, the book is about a transformational coming of age and understanding the frailties and limitations of the people you love. And for me, it was a bird's eye view into the other side of the world, the side of the world that I hadn't seen or known. And I do think it fundamentally changed me for the rest of my life.
And I want to ask you about that in a minute, but I want to get back to what you said about sort of understanding the frailties of the people you love and your parents and their decision to do this. And to you had a lot of siblings. Your siblings weren't even aware that this was going on. What was the story
Correct.
That they told your family, the rest of the family?
Yes, they told the family and all my friends, my grandparents, my siblings. I'm one of seven kids, that I was sick and away at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And eventually, during the writing of the book, I realized that it was quite crazy that perhaps nobody in the world knew where I was except for my parents, and no one came knocking for me. But, you know, it seemed to work, kind of. I obviously, it was rumored all over my hometown that I was gone having a baby. But my mother's attitude was, I mean, she genuinely believed if this got out that my life would be ruined. And in turn, I believed her. So she basically said, if you just never admit it, people can think what they think, but they'll never know. So that's really what I walked away with. If I never tell, my life will be okay.
So this is 1979. Do you feel like at that point, when you were that age, when you were 16 in the North Shore of Chicago, did you know of any girls who had gotten pregnant?
No.
So this was really, you were just sort of thinking, I'm the only one. I'm going to be the
Correct.
One person in Winnetka that everybody has ruined her life, essentially.
Correct.
Okay.
Cut to the 10 emails I've gotten on my website of other girls on the North Shore who got pregnant. Everybody's story is a little different, but of course, yes, I thought I was the only one. And genuinely, I didn't have reason to question the authority and the choices of my parents. I was a minor kid, and they were good people, and I'd had a great life, and I trusted them my whole life. I just trusted that this was the right thing to do.
You trusted them, but there's this moment that you write in the book, Liz, and you write, I'm completely alone. For the first time in my life, I had no one and nowhere to turn. And certainly the first couple of weeks when you're in there, your mom says she's going to come visit and she doesn't. You talk to your dad. You talk to them on the phone. Your stepmother actually is the one who, your father's second wife is the one who actually sends you food and the things that you need. That first month, what was your, how, I mean, that must have been such a painful place to be in, to be a 17-year-old going through a pregnancy on her own, surrounded by people she's never been in, a completely foreign environment.
Correct. You know, it's interesting when I look back on it. I think, you know, going through something so difficult at such a young age is definitely one of those experiences that forces you to call upon your strength and your confidence and your faith. I had no idea at the time, but in retrospect, it was lonely. It was terrifyingly lonely, but at the same time, it was very strengthening. So, you know, the old adage that you come in alone and you go out alone, I think I was forced a little bit early to call upon my real self. And I do think throughout my life, very few things have happened that deep inside myself, I don't think I can do this because of this situation. So I did trust my parents and love them and didn't really question their authority, but it forced me to learn myself and frankly come to some decisions and ideas about life that were in opposition with my parents. I felt very differently about the girls. I mean, ultimately, I created these great bonds and, you know, learned that at the end of the day, we were all teenagers, pregnant and terrified. And I sort of got through our differences and came to see a lot of life that I think my parents never saw.
I'm speaking to Liz Pryor. Her memoir is called Look at You Now, My Journey from Shame to Strength. We're talking about her story of her childhood and as a young woman. And as you're thinking about that, Liz, as you're saying about the experiences you had that were different from your parents, I'm thinking about the young women that were in the facility with you. Some of them were barely literate, and you decide you're going to start helping them and read to them, and you kind of mobilize everybody to have more of a school situation. At the time, do you think it was just an impulse you had where I just want to fix this situation, or I want to make it better, or where did that come from?
I think so. I'm not sure. I think I just did what I knew, which is to make the best of a tough situation. And it did seem, I really do remember thinking, this can't be that these girls go up to school every day and sit in a room and sleep. Basically, in the book, there's, you know, the first time I go to their quote-unquote school, it's just a room with a few paperbacks and some magazines. Nobody reads. The teacher doesn't do anything. I think it was just sort of in my nature to imagine if we're going to do this every day, week after week after month, I just took what I knew from my own childhood about reading and word searches, and I, you know, just tried to make it a little bit better, probably for myself and for them. I don't really see myself as some sort of, you know, helper of all good deeds. I think it was an innocent, let's do this, let's have fun, let's learn. And the closer I grew to the girls, the more I realized how smart some of them really were about life. And, you know, eventually there's a scene in there, the first scene when I bring up that my baby will be given up for adoption, does not get met well by any of these girls whose dream is to have a baby, have somebody to love and someone to love them back, thinking it will fix their lives, when so many of them confess to having 14, 15-year-old mothers. So as a young girl, I think I just thought it didn't make sense. And eventually, some of them came to see that it might be a good idea to go back to high school and wait to have children and raise children when you're more stable and have a job and perhaps a father for the child.
And you were an influence on, and in fact, the social worker who's working at the facility tells your mother what an influence you're being on the girls and how they're starting to think about adoption as an option. And that had never happened before at the facility they were at. What was your mother's response to all of that?
Yeah, my mother did not want to hear anything about my engaging or connecting or becoming a part of this world that she was clearly so uncomfortable in. It was a big moment in the book because if you had to think about it, it was my first real pull away from my parents and the things that they think about life. I felt it viscerally, and I remember it viscerally, that she was upset and uncomfortable hearing that I had made a place here for myself. She didn't want to hear the good news. That's not because she doesn't love me. I think it's just because she comes from a certain world and a certain time. She just wanted this experience to go away as fast as it could. But in the book, there's a scene where the social worker, you know, compliments me or tries to compliment me to my mother, and she just won't have it. She stands up and basically says that my purpose of being there is just to have this child and move on. It is not to engage. And I stay seated and thank the social worker and feel for the first time that I legitimately oppose what she is thinking inside of her heart, which is all of us do about our parents. This is a significant one. I think it was the beginning of realizing that I was autonomous and I was going to grow up to be my own person with my own thoughts and my own experiences.
Liz, I want to ask you about what you were thinking personally as you were going through the pregnancy. And there is this juxtaposition of you seeing the other women who are with you and how much they're so excited about being pregnant and how much they're looking forward to the baby. And you're not even really acknowledging that you are pregnant because I don't know how much of that was just you kind of realizing, look, I'm going to be giving this baby up for adoption. What was that like for you?
Yeah, I think there was a combination of, in the writing of it, I just remember that I was in that facility 3 days after I learned I was pregnant. So So I had barely mentally come around to the notion. Yes, I think part of it was keeping myself distanced from the baby growing in my tummy because, you know, I was a huge, huge lover of little kids. I didn't put it in the book, but, you know, my mother used to get mad at me for how much fun and how much I adored, you know, little children. And I think it was one of her real reasons for making sure that I didn't hold this baby. So, yes, I think it was extremely difficult, the reality of hearing these girls talk about the babies and what they wanted to name them and where they were going to live and how they were going to do it, when my plan was to give up the baby, not hold it, and carry on with my life. Very difficult.
And what was it like for you now, almost 40 years later, as you started to write about that moment, especially after you give birth and you do give the baby up?
Well, you know, the perspective now feels very different because I have three children. I got married and had three kids. So things start tomorrow. The beauty of this story, I think, is that earnestly, I had never told a single soul. I had never spoken the words out loud of my experience from beginning to end. Nobody. My parents had no idea, really, what went on inside those walls. So the writing of it was obviously emotional. Really emotional at times, but and terrifying at times, but obviously cathartic. And really, I think what happened to me as I grew up was when my children became of age, you know, sex and love, and they became the age that I was, it was almost too much for me to bear. And I felt really strongly about not perpetuating the notion that something happens to you in life and you need to hide it. I really wanted my children to understand that whatever we go through, whatever version of an untold truth or whatever experience somebody has, A, you know, you don't have to be defined by one single experience, and B, there really always is a way to get through it. I wanted to send that message to my kids and then further beyond my kids, that life is not defined by the things that happen to you. It's defined by how you handle it.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Liz Pryor. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In the past hour, by the way, Bernie Sanders has endorsed Hillary Clinton at a rally in New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders says Clinton must become the next president because she can take on issues like income inequality, climate change, and student debt. We'll have more on that endorsement in the rest of the day's political news coming throughout the day from NPR News. Right now, we're speaking with Liz Pryor. She's telling us the story of her childhood as a young adult, as a young woman growing up in suburban Chicago. Her parents sending her to a government-run facility in order to keep her pregnancy a secret. Her book is called Look at You Now, My Journey from Shame to Strength. Liz is speaking to us from California, where she lives now. She's coming back to Illinois. Tomorrow, she's going to be speaking in Chicago. Thursday, she's going back to Winnetka, to her hometown. And then she's got an event on Friday in Lake Forest. Liz, with so many events in the area, what's it going to be like for you to come back and share the story in your hometown where you grew up?
You know, I think it's going to be pretty amazing. I was trepidatious, you know, when you spend a lifetime hiding and running. I couldn't be any further unless I fell into the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
But it's amazing. It's changed so much in the last week. I've just had such an influx of incredible support and compassion and from lots of people on the North Shore and obviously other readers. I feel really comfortable and excited about going back and sort of facing the elephant in the eyes. It's important for me, it's important for my family, and I kind of want people to understand that, you know, we're just people. This was a choice that I made, and I'm going back to what we were talking about earlier with my mother. I really do think part of the reason, I think I was very much made to feel that what happened here was my fault. And so I really don't know if I think I felt that my parents were doing anything other than saying, listen, this is what you did, and this is what we're going to have to do to get you through it. Of course, 40 years later, I can question that. But I really did feel responsible for the possible ruin of my family's name and my own life. But Winnetka, I very much look forward to going back. You know, I've gone back to visit. My little sisters live there. And I think it's going to be quite exciting.
Liz, did you stay in touch with your boyfriend at the time? And I should make a note to, he was in college, so he was a little older than you. Did you guys ever stay in touch?
Oh, yeah, we stayed in touch throughout the years. And he's very proud of this book. And, yeah, you know, I think he felt terrible, but he was pretty out of it. My parents made all these decisions, and he was a freshman in college, and his life had moved on. But great guy, and, you know, he feels guilty to this day for the experience that I had, particularly after reading the book.
When did you start to tell people about this? Who was the first person you told?
You're not going to like this answer. The very first time I ever told the entire story was the writing of this book. So my siblings only heard this story for the first time when they read the manuscript about 8 months ago.
Wow.
Yeah, I told the man I married that I had a child and that I was sent away. He comes from a very different background and had very little response to it, really. And then I told my best friend growing up, and I really didn't tell her the whole story either. So I truly, one of the reasons I thought the book might work is because the notion of telling a story that's never been told, of course I've never done that, but as a writer, you know, I could only tell this from the point of view of the 17-year-old girl. And it's as though all of these memories and experiences are, it's almost as though it was preserved in ember in the way that nothing changed. And really, particularly reading the book, I did the audio, I narrated the audio. It really is a wonderful way to tell a story, something that you've never told, so it doesn't change over time. And everything feels so vivid to me when I was writing it.
Liz, you're a life coach. Good Morning America viewers might recognize you. You were GMA's Dear Abby for a little bit. I wonder if part of telling your story was sort of you realizing you're giving lots of people relationship advice and life advice, and you felt like you kind of needed to reconcile that within yourself?
I don't know. I could say one of the most challenging parts of writing the book was that I am a commenter. I am a person who weighs in, and in this book, I really come at you as though you're standing behind my eyeballs. It was difficult as a writer not to comment on anything and to just give the story. I think one of the reasons I really wanted to tell this story was because I get a lot of people looking at me after reading this and saying, you do not seem like someone who went through something like that. And I think that's a pretty global comment. Again, back to the notion that, you know, you don't have to be defined by one single event in your life. I wanted to tell the story to get people to see that there is a way. There is a way within you to find the strength to believe in yourself and to not allow yourself to be defined by what other people think. I just didn't want to be reduced to anybody imagining what might have gone on in high school. I wanted to stand behind it, show my children and the community and everybody else who lives with any version of an untold truth that there's a way through it, and sometimes it can end up beautiful.
What has been your family's response? First, your siblings. What was your siblings' response when they read the manuscript?
You know, it was varied. Obviously, this is a big and heavy story and lots of information about my parents that they didn't know. So obviously very supportive. They're very proud. But I think it was difficult for some of them, very difficult. This was a time in our life, all of our lives, when my parents' divorce was very difficult. I had two younger siblings at home still. Always felt very guilty about the armor they must have had to wear when I went off to college, and there were tons of rumors. But listen, there is no question that the most difficult part of this story for me in my life was not being able to share my truth. It really, really causes a wedge between you and the people you love. It is so much easier to put it out in the open.
And did you feel that way with your children as well?
Yes, I definitely. Well, I raised my children a bit differently. We're very open and very communicative. And honestly, you know, the shame that I've lived with for all this time, it doesn't just come out because you write a book. It lives there. It's embedded. It tends to ooze out in little pieces. But I could never have written the book if my children were to feel embarrassed or ashamed or uncomfortable in any way. So it was critical. I went to each of them separately. They're 17, 19, and 21 now. But when I started, they were a couple years younger. And I was so relieved and pleased with their open hearts and their lack of judgment and, you know, sort of their onboardship of, yes, Mom, this is okay with us.
Are your kids coming with you for the going back to Illinois?
They're not. They're going to all the signings here in LA, and I have a daughter in New York who's at an internship, so she can't come.
Okay. I guess my question for you is, why now? Like, we just have about a minute left, but I just wanted to ask you, what was it that finally got you to write this?
Well, I think one of the reasons was, you know, but my mother passed away four years ago, and I asked her before she died how she would feel about me writing this story in a book, and she said, you do whatever you want, sweetheart, look at you now. So, which thus the title of the book. I think with my mother's passing, sort of the key unlocked the lock, and then with the kids coming of age, and I'm a writer, and it's a heck of a story, and I think, you know, maybe other people who live with any version of this might be inspired to come out with the truth. Because the truth really does set you free in so many ways.
Liz Pryor, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. You can see her in person if you are in Winnetka, Lake Forest, or Chicago. We'll have all the details about that up at our website at www.21stshow.org. We'll tweet them out as well if you follow the 21st. I want to thank Liz Pryor for joining us. Again, she's a speaker, she's a life coach, and she's an author. Her book is called Look at You Now, My Journey from Shame to Strength. Thanks so much, Liz.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday in Chicago, more than 200 teenagers sat in a silent protest at Millennium Park. It was a protest organized by Black Lives Matter Youth Chicago to protest in particular the recent shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling. Joining us now is one of the four teenage women who organized the sit-in. Sophia Bird is a 17-year-old. She's going to be a senior at Whitney Young High School in Chicago. Hi, Sophia. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What inspired you all to organize this protest yesterday?
I think just the passion to share with the world that teenagers can make a difference. Teenagers can do more than sit on their couch and tweet a hashtag. They can actually get out and take action to make a change.
And do you feel like usually protests are for adults? You really wanted this to be a space specifically for teenagers.
Yes, that's right. We really marketed it towards teenagers, because oftentimes I think that teens don't come out to support protests and marches because they don't feel that it's directed for them and they don't feel welcome. So we wanted to create a space specifically for teens.
And what did you say? How did you market it to people?
We just told them, hey, like, you should come out. This is so important. It is our future. We need to take it into our own hands and make a difference. So please tell your friends, bring your family. And then people started asking, is it safe for young children? And we said, for sure, bring them. This is the perfect space for kids to come and start civil service young, because it was so peaceful. And we were going to be sitting and just listening to people talk. People shared some poems and songs.
Can you describe what it was like yesterday to be involved in the protest? What happened to it?
It was overwhelming. I really wasn't expecting such a large turnout. So it took me a long time to actually process everything that was happening. But in the end, I feel that it was really empowering, and I was so proud to be one of the four people that got it going. So proud of my friends, the four girls that started it with me, and so thankful to everyone that came out to support.
Now, the four of you, you're four young African-American women. How long have you been involved in the Black Lives Matter youth movement?
Well, for me, I've been marching to protest against the police brutality and gun violence since I was 7 or 8 with my church. But recently, one of the girls, Maxine, and I had done some work towards talking about black hair, and it being beautiful, so that's how we'd work together. I'm not sure about the other two girls directly, but I know that they've participated in Louder Than a Bomb and have spoken out about Black Lives Matter before also.
So, Faye, can I ask you what was going through your mind last week as we had first the fatal shooting of Alton Sterling, then Philando Castile, then the events in Dallas?
Yeah, so my heart truly, truly hurt. I was really at a loss for words for a long amount of time, and I really wasn't sure if there was anything to be done, just because it felt like everyone has been protesting for so long, and yet still nothing changes. And my heart really breaks for the families of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, as well as those of the police officers who lost their lives in Dallas. But at times like these, it really becomes important to take action.
And what was the message behind organizing a silent sit-in? Why was that important for you to do?
The silence is, first of all, representative of the silence that people feel when we are told that our lives don't matter, when we are put in situations where we feel that Black lives don't matter. But also the silence is just really supposed to be representative of us trying to combat the violence with peace. So it was an attempt, and a successful attempt at that, to keep the protest peaceful. And that was also the purpose of sitting down, was to just make sure that no violence arose and that no one got rowdy.
And in fact, Sophia, I know a police officer reached out to you in the beginning of the protest and asked how they could help and accommodate you. What was that moment like for you?
It almost brought me to tears. It was such a powerful and amazing thing to see the police officers wanting to work with us to help us and to make a difference, and they wanted to be a part of it. And they offered to shut down Michigan Avenue for us so that we would have a place to march and we wouldn't have to worry about getting hit by cars or trying to get through the traffic. So I just thought it was really a testament to how we are seeing change and how our protests really did make a change, because that's not something that you see every day, the protesters working with the police officers to make a statement.
Sophia, you're 17. You're about to be a high school senior. What message do you want to send to other people your age throughout Illinois?
I think that everyone should just know that no matter what age you are, no matter what your racial background is, no matter what gender you are, you can make a difference. You can do something. You can take your own future into your own hands. And I think that that doesn't just apply to the Black Lives Matter movement, that applies to any movement. There's so many social justice movements going on right now, and I think that that can apply to all of them.
Sophia Byrd is about to start her high school senior year at Whitney Young High in Chicago. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us, Sophia. I know you've got to head off to work. Thanks.
Thank you.
And by the way, President Obama is on his way to Dallas. He actually should probably be there by now. He's taking part in an interfaith memorial service that's going to be held at the Meyerson Symphony Center to remember the police officers killed in Dallas last week. President Obama is expected to speak, as is former President George W. Bush. Stay tuned to NPR News throughout the day for coverage of that. Coming up on the 21st, have you played Pokemon Go yet? I have. It's the craze that we're going to be talking about how everyone in Illinois has caught on to the augmented reality game. Here's what Shanna said on Facebook. If you sit in the middle of a few Pokestops, you can lure all of them and catch a bunch of Pokemon. And not to mention, if there are other people around you, they might start a chain reaction. Do you not know what that means? We're going to explain all of that coming up on the 21st. We're also collating tips for people in Illinois. So stay tuned. We're going to be talking about that. Well, Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's been all over the news, all over our social media feeds, drawing crowds in parks and other landmarks. Safe to say that Pokemon Go is the latest craze. In less than a week since it launched, the app has amassed millions of users, young and old. It's breaking records on iOS, Android. Nintendo stock is soaring. And Business Insider reports that Pokemon Go is already bigger than the dating app Tinder, and it's set to overtake Twitter any day now. Of course, people all over Illinois are not immune and are getting into the craze as well. Our intern, Ben Thomas Payne, yesterday went out to talk to some of them and brought us back this postcard.
What are you guys doing out here?
Pokemon.
My name is Spencer. I study computer engineering. I'm playing Pokemon Go and collecting Pokeballs by flipping signs around on campus. A Pokestop is it's like a real physical location that on the virtual map marks a place where you can get items. And campus is loaded with these things. They're literally everywhere, and I just leveled up to level 7.
What is that? That's a Rattata. I already have a Rattata, but I'll get another one. Got him.
I am Nicholas Mann. I work in town as a photographer. I don't have to go to work today, so instead I'm hunting Pokemon. I did come here because there's a lure. A lure is something that increases the generation rate, so somebody can drop one on a Pokestop, and it increases the generation rate of Pokemon there, so everybody crowds around there in hopes that they'll find more Pokemon. I was playing it last night at about 11:30, and I took over a gym over in Carl Park, and right after that happened, a car pulled up, stopped, nobody got out, but about a minute later, I had lost that gym. So, there are people around at night, and they're prowling.
I think it's the most interesting game that's, like, ever happened to Earth at this point. The fact that I was walking around through the night at, like, 3 a.m. with another person, and there were just a bunch of people around in the neighborhood trying to catch Pokemon, and, like, I was just walking, and someone was like, hey, if you need a Zubat, there's a Zubat over here, and I was just like, what is going on right now? What is planet Earth these days?
Thanks to Ben Thomas Payne for that. Speaking to Champaign-Urbana users of Pokemon Go on the University of Illinois campus. By the way, there's a Pokestop that's right outside our station at Friends Plaza for those of you who are in the area or maybe in the need of that. So that's my tip for you. We're collecting other local tips for this game. You can post them to our Facebook page, search for the 21st and like us there. We've got a thread going, or you can tweet to 21st Show. Joining us now to talk about all of this, not just the fun, but the serious, the privacy and everything else around this, is Jennifer Golbeck. She's the director of the Social Intelligence Lab at the University of Maryland. Jennifer, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
I think a lot of the news coverage is touting all of the benefits, and certainly that's what we're hearing from lots of people who are playing. We got a Facebook comment from Christian. He said, don't be afraid to talk to other people or ask them if they've seen a certain Pokemon that you're looking for. Everyone's enjoying the game. They want you to do the same. This game has a crazy way of bringing strangers together. Do you think that's what made Pokemon Go so popular so fast?
You know, I think that's definitely part of it. And that's something that we've seen in previous location-based games that are actually quite different, like geocaching, where you go out, you don't have to look at your phone the whole time, and you actually go find real physical treasures hidden out there in the world. And that's something that I've done extensively. That game has been around since 2001. And if you go out to those places, especially on the weekends, people will be like, oh, are you looking for the cache? Like, you may want to try over here. Here's a hint for you. So being out kind of socially playing a game like out in the world and other people are playing it definitely draws people to it. So I think there's a real nostalgia aspect. There's a lot of older people playing this compared to what you might expect. People who played Pokemon as kids or who watched the TV show who are kind of my age or a little bit younger, kind of in their 30s. And so I think there's this great nostalgia of taking this thing you played as a kid and suddenly here it is in this other form.
At the same time, I should say there have been a few concerns with the app. The most immediately reports of people maybe getting lured literally into areas, you know, so that lured is actually a term in the app to inform others of a Pokemon that you found. But there could be people who are not using those for great purposes, including maybe robbing or harming them. What do people need to do to stay safe while playing Pokemon Go?
Yeah, so there are reported cases, like true reported cases, of people who will set up lures to draw Pokemon players to a particular spot, and then they were robbing them. I think it was four teenage guys who were using this technique. You know, I think it's the same kind of safety strategies that you would use with any kind of thing you're doing that gets you out there, you know, walking around in the world. You know, in Champaign-Urbana, you have a little less to worry about than I do, like in Washington, D.C., if I'm walking around in the middle of the night. But, you know, there's places that I feel safe walking around in the middle of the night and places I don't. There's strangers that I would walk up to in the middle of the night and those that I wouldn't. And the same kind of guidelines that you should use to keep yourself safe in general, you should use when you're playing the game. You know, don't assume just because you're having a great time that everybody that you run into is also out there having that great time.
Right. And it's a good reminder for parents as well. I know a lot of kids have started using the app. Certainly, you wouldn't let your kids sort of just wander off with the phone. So it's just a little common sense. You know, we've been asking our listeners for their best tips on Pokemon Go. And Alexa says, catch everything. This is what she said on Facebook. It'll always give you experience points, candy, and Stardust, and you can use that. And Nadia says, use the power saver mode. Then you can tilt your phone down and the screen will be dark and you can save power. I did notice my battery died very quickly yesterday. What tips do you have for someone who's just getting started on this?
Yeah, you know, one thing that I would say to keep in mind, so I have a 15-year-old stepdaughter, and my husband was taking her to space camp this weekend, and she is on her mom's data plan, and she used the whole data plan up this weekend playing Pokemon
Go.
Oh,
no.
Which, like, I hadn't even thought about, but that's an important thing to keep in mind, that you use a ton of data because you're constantly, you know, transmitting your location, you're looking around, you're doing stuff, and so you want to keep that in mind so you don't run out your data plan.
That's a really good point.
It's hard to use Wi-Fi for this because you're moving around, but if you're in a place where you can connect to Wi-Fi and you're doing Pokemon Go, that might be a good idea too.
So you've been trying this app out. Do you like it?
I actually kind of hate it.
Why do you hate it?
To say. So I downloaded it. It's like my job to know about these things, right? I study social media and mobile interaction and all these things. So I'm like, all right, I have to go try it. So I downloaded it, and I, like, go out, and I'm walking down the sidewalk outside my house, and I was like, please don't let anybody see me doing this, because I was that guy that we all love to hate, right? I'm, like, walking down the sidewalk. You have to stare at your phone the whole time because there's, like, you know, a map, and you can see where all of the spots are, the Pokemons and the gyms and the lures and everything. And so you're totally unaware of what's going around you. You're just staring at your phone. And if you look at the videos that people have posted from over the weekend, you know, like, here's all these people in Central Park just, like, blindly wandering around, staring in their phone, unaware of the environment. And I don't know, you know, like I mentioned when I started, I'm a big geocacher. And for people who aren't familiar with that, basically it's not a corporately controlled entity. Anyone can go out and you hide sometimes little things, but often, you know, big kind of waterproof boxes out in the woods in secret places, and you post the GPS location, and people go find them, and they open the box, and you leave little trinkets in there. And so in one sense, it's the same. You're looking for stuff in the real world. On the other hand, geocaching, like, you're very aware of your environment because you don't have to stare at your phone until you're right on top of the thing. You're finding real stuff. Like, there's a real challenge out there. And this is just, like, so virtual and kind of takes you out of the real world. Like, even though you are outside, you're not engaging with the environment. I found it really jarring to have to be absorbed in the phone and ignoring the whole world around me. So I got up to a level 3 and then I turned it off.
Yeah, I started playing yesterday morning before the show, which was not a great idea. And then felt like a complete jerk at lunch because I was in downtown Champaign and they were everywhere and I was catching one and the waitress came up and I just thought, I can't keep my phone out. I have to put this away. My friend is just looking at me like, why are you trying to catch something that's on the table? The waitress was just looking at me. And the funny thing is everybody who was outside was walking around and they were all playing. So you can see everybody who's playing. But can you explain the whole, because your phone has to be out. So people who are not aware of this, it's augmented reality. How does that work?
Yeah, so it's interesting. This is kind of a combination, like, video game augmented reality. So classic augmented reality, like pre-Pokemon Go, you could imagine. And Google Glass really tried to do this, if you remember when that was the big thing. But you could also imagine it with your phone. The app that I really want that's augmented reality is that you can hold it up and it knows, like, it does facial recognition on the person in front of you and it shows their name over their face because I always forget people's names. Like, that's augmented reality, right? That you see the world around you and then there's stuff put on top of it. And so this is not the first augmented reality video game, but definitely the first kind of breakout hit. So you have a kind of cartoon map that you're walking on most of the time. So you're not really seeing the world around you, but you're seeing a Google's view of the street. And then when you come on one of these Pokemons that are kind of planted in the world, it turns on your camera. So you see the actual scene in front of you on your phone, and then the little Pokemon character is there, and you have a little game interface. You can throw balls at it and try to catch it. And so you're seeing the real world, but with other stuff laid on top of it, which certainly is really engaging, right? You look there with your actual eyes, and you don't see anything, but you look through your phone, and there's this extra layer on top of it.
And we've been talking about all of the good things about it, the technology, the things people need to be careful about. I stopped using it yesterday afternoon because I realized that I had logged in with my Google account, and I read all of the stories saying there's some serious privacy concerns because I had allowed it entire access to my entire Gmail and my entire Google account, not just Docs and everything like that. Even though there was an emergency fix put out, the company said, we know we have access to all your information. We're not looking at it. I wonder about what your perspective is on the privacy side of all of this.
This is a thing that I go around and like try to warn every person that I can find about at all times. Like every time
you can warn everyone who's listening in Illinois. Go ahead.
Yeah. So this is the case with a lot of apps, but we saw it here where instead of just creating an account for Pokemon, you can log in with your Google account. So you just use your Google, your Gmail, or your Google username and password, and that is what logs you into Pokemon. And when you did this, it turned out that they were using kind of an old version of the authentication, and that got them access to all your emails, everything you wanted. They requested full access to everything. I think that was probably an oversight. Like some programmer probably was just like checked the box for everything. Nobody went back and looked at it. I don't think they had any evil intent to like scan all your emails.
Although they could have.
They could have, right? And you know, maybe I'm being naive, but I kind of believe them that that wasn't really their intent. But the thing is, like, how many people downloaded this? I mean, millions of people downloaded this and logged in that way. I think totally unaware that they were handing over full access to their accounts. And in fact, that happens with a lot of apps that you give away a huge amount of information through the login and a huge amount of information on your phone, right? Nintendo is now collecting everybody's movements everywhere all the time. They have this huge database of everybody's GPS movements and whatever else they can pull from your phone. And I think this is just something that we're not careful enough about yet, is how much access to our data we hand over when we install an app. And a lot of times it's totally opaque, like you don't even know what you're handing over. But there's a huge security risk that can come with that. You know, I think the Pokemon Go people are trustworthy, that they weren't scanning your messages, that they're going to fix it. It'll be fine. But who knows about all those other apps that we download, you know, what they're pulling, what they're accessing, and, you know, are they selling it? What are they going to do with it? There's a lot of power that comes with that data. And we just don't have a really good, sophisticated mechanism to warn us about what we're handing over or to even help us make those decisions.
Jennifer, this is, as you said, this is your job. You study this. You're the director of the Social Intelligence Lab at the University of Maryland. Where do we draw the line? Because I feel like there's always the kind of extreme privacy people who have all of their cameras on their laptops taped up and don't keep their phone in their bedroom. And then there's everyone else who just sort of doesn't pay attention. I think we probably need to figure out some sort of middle ground. What would that be?
Yeah, so I definitely am on that far end of the spectrum. I'm looking at my taped up camera on my laptop right now. But yeah, you know, I don't expect everyone to be as extreme as I am about it, but I think we want to think a little more carefully because there is a huge amount of power in this data, as I said. A lot of what I do in my regular life is kind of figuring out people's secrets by analyzing their data, stuff that they haven't explicitly said, and artificial intelligence is getting really good at that. So, like, thing one is people have to understand a lot can be found out about them from sharing their data, so it is important to keep it private. And then thing two is, all right, well, how do we protect that data while also being able to participate in the world? Because to do that, you have to be online, right? You could not do any social media, not do email, but there's a real cost that comes with that too. So I think that there's some like common sense solutions. And when I was talking to your producer before the show, she was like, well, you have to log in with Google. Did you log in with your Gmail account? And I have a fake Gmail account. I have one.
Oh,
that's
a great tip for us. I'm afraid we're out of time, but thanks for that. Thanks so much for joining us. Jennifer Golbeck is the director of the Social Intelligence Lab at the University of Maryland. On tomorrow's program, we'll be talking about what you can do to protect yourself against financial exploitation and scams, especially in regards to the elderly. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. Have a great day.